Today's show is brought to you by Queen of Raw. Wouldn't it be great if there were an online marketplace that offered innovative and sustainable fabrics at low minimums and affordable prices? Check out queenofraw.com. No one does it like the Queen.
Hi, you're listening to Magnifico Radio, and I'm your host, Kate Black. Each week, I sit down with leaders, makers, and designers at the forefront of sustainability to discuss their journeys and motivation. Whether it's ethical fashion, clean beauty, or sustainable products, they're all doing something Magnifico. Today's guest started sewing when she was 13. She fell in love with the son of a famous shoemaker at 16 and decided she could and would make fashion her career. She studied fashion design at Ryerson University in Toronto, interned with Vivienne Westwood, and launched an eco brand with Lululemon founder Chip Wilson before heading out on her own and launching her eponymous ethical line, Nicole Bridger. Welcome, Nikki.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So let's just start right in the deep end. What does ethical fashion mean to you?
The mantra of my company is I am love, and I believe that our true essence is pure love. And that we're having this earthly existence to figure out how to come from that place in all that we do, in all the facets of our lives. So when I was creating the business, how that sort of showed up is to do what is right for the earth, its people, and spirit. So for the earth, it's about sustainability. The textile industry is currently like the second most polluting in the world. And we need to find a way to live in harmony with our planet. Otherwise, we won't be able to live here. And then for the people, we practice ethical manufacturing wherever we are, whether that's locally or overseas. And to me, that means that the workers are treated with respect, that they have a clean, good working environment, that they're being paid fair wages. A lot of people don't know that the apparel industry relies very heavily on forced labor. And currently there's an estimated, 35 million slaves in the world, men, women, and children. So it's still a big issue. And I just don't believe that we need anything bad enough for someone somewhere to be suffering to create it. And then for spirit, it's about reminding everyone about their true essence. So we put a label in each piece of clothing that says, I am love. And it reminds you, the wearer, to come from that place throughout your day. And that starts with loving yourself just how you are. And then also being kind to others throughout your day. And reminding you to continue to make more mindful choices throughout your life.
How much of that comes from where you live versus like how you've kind of evolved? Because you're one of the kind of stalwarts in this industry that started ethical and is still ethical a decade later. And yes, you've had some bumps, and we're going to talk about that in this show, but you've really kind of slugged it out for over a decade. So how much of that has been a work in progress, this perspective, and how much did you kind of come to it at the very beginning?
I think it's always been a part of me. I think definitely growing up in Vancouver and being close to nature and growing up with David Suzuki teaching us about the importance of nature and really valuing it, it has been big. And also I grew up in the 80s when in Vancouver recycling became very popular. And I think every school play I ever did from kindergarten up was about reduce, reuse, recycle. So it was ingrained in us really early that this was something important. I think also my parents are very generous, loving people. And I've always had this sense of gratitude for the life that I have been given. And I felt this deep desire to give back to the world in whatever way that I could with the years that I have on this planet, to have some kind of positive impact.
I'm just curious, did you take that perspective with you when you went to Ryerson? Like, were you like, yes, I'm going to be a designer, but I'm going to be this kind of designer?
Yes, and actually, yeah, it was tricky because I wasn't quite sure how the two could work together. And in university, there was a group of us that were like-minded. We did yoga, we ate organic food when we could, and we all used natural fibers in our collections. Some of the girls were repurposing old sailcloths or playing with natural dyes. And so we had this kind of collective conversation about, you know, we like the apparel industry, we like making clothes, but how do we do it in a way that we know is responsible? And that was a long time before the word eco-fashion was even around. It was just what we knew was the right thing to do. And I had no idea how big the problem was at that time. I just knew that if I was going to create something, that it had to be in harmony.
I think, yeah, and I think a lot of people at that time were just starting to think about that. And so when you went to intern with Vivienne Westwood, was she thinking about that at that time, or did you catch her at an evolution before that had kind of come into her consciousness as well?
No, I think she's always been like that. You know, when I knew her, she rode her bicycle everywhere. She would stop and pick up a banana peel off the side of the road to put it in her compost. She has always been an advocate for change, even in her sort of anarchist years and punk movement. That's what that was all about, right? It was, hey, wait a minute, we don't like what's going on here, let's change. And it created a whole movement which had a style around it. But that's what it was about. And she's never stopped being that advocate for change.
And did you know that you were going to have that kind of symbiotic outlook when you went there to go and intern with her?
I knew these things about her, and that was the only reason that I went, was to have a chance to work with her. I had a question in my mind whether I could exist in the fashion industry and not sell my soul. And I had no interest in selling my soul. So she showed me that you can be whoever you are and exist in any industry, really.
But funnily enough, wasn't that an era when she was having really big financial crisis? Weren't you kind of
huge? Yeah.
Torn with this idea of, yes, you can be everything you want, but it might not financially work out.
Exactly. Yeah. And how do you do both? So she had already gone through one bankruptcy, and I had seen what it looks like when somebody else comes in and buys half your company, and the sort of split that was existing within the company. And she was facing a second bankruptcy when I was there, and I thought, well, this is great. Here's this creative genius, but if we don't understand the business, the economics of this, then, you know, I can't make any positive change. And it's been a journey learning how to do that. And working with Chip Wilson was all about that for me. You know, how do you create something that's financially sustainable? What does that look like?
Yeah, because we have several really successful fashion kind of icons coming out of Canada, right? There's Joe Mimran, there's Chip Wilson from Lululemon. Joe Mimran started Club Monaco and then went on to start Joe Fresh. And so we kind of have this legacy of very successful fashion brands, maybe not necessarily eco, but definitely doing fashion in a profitable way. So when you came home after Vivienne, did you know Chip already, or did you kind of find each other in...
I had worked a couple of summers with him. Actually, it's a funny story how we met. My dad and him were in the locker change room at the gym, and both, I think, buck naked. And he was talking to somebody about wanting fashion interns or something. And my dad said, oh, my daughter is in fashion school right now. So my dad gave me his number. And so I went and interned. Well, yes, I worked with him for a couple summers, I think, during university. And this was very early in Lululemon days. It was just upstairs on 4th. And by the time I was there, they were downstairs, and upstairs was the office. And I started the hemming department, and we created the first headband out of the bottom of pants that we chopped off. So it was really early days.
Oh, my goodness. The first upcycled product at Lululemon. And so when you guys launched that kind of eco diffusion brand, was it a diffusion brand or was it a whole other brand?
It was a whole other brand, but it was financed by Lululemon.
And was it successful?
Yeah, it was. I think it had 6 stores before they closed. They closed when the CEO from Reebok came in and had specific ideas about what he wanted to do with the company, with Lululemon. He just wanted to focus on Lululemon and not grow Fococo.
And that's when you knew that you had to go and step out on your own.
I was already gone. I promised him to be there for a year because I wanted to learn business, marketing, accounting, supply chain. And so I said I would help him create this thing for a year. And I was there for 2 years. And by the end of that, once you have learned everything you need to learn and you're not growing anymore, I became stifled and unhappy and just needed to go.
And so you took the pieces that you had from your childhood, the pieces that you picked up from your little tribe at Ryerson, the pieces from Vivian Westwood, and then the pieces from this, what was it called, the Lululemon line?
Fococo. Yeah.
So you have all of this to launch Nicole Bridger proper.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so when was that?
So 2006, I wrote a business plan. And our first collection, I think, was in 2007, maybe 2006. And it was just 5 pieces. I was doing some custom stuff first while I was writing the business plan. I bought a few machines. I set up in my parents' basement. It was just me doing all the pattern making, sewing, marketing, everything.
In 2007?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good year. That's when Vanity Fair had the green issue. That's when I launched.
Oh, okay.
Magnifico was 2007.
Awesome. And it was difficult, I found, to find retailers that understood both design and being ethical. It was kind of one or the other at the time. And so our best sales were just out of the basement, which eventually became out of the garage. So I would hold sales out of the house.
Was your mom also at a gym? Was she hawking her daughter's wares out of the locker room at her gym?
Actually, I think my mom probably is our biggest supporter. She's probably bought more clothes than anybody.
And so now that it's been over a decade, what would you say is the evolution of this kind of term eco? Or what have you noticed the most about our industry and the kind of the ups and downs over the last decade?
I think what's been interesting is when we first launched is that I really kept the eco thing under wraps. I didn't think that I would be taken seriously as an eco designer, and I didn't want to be pigeonholed. She's just an eco designer. And so it's always been there, but it was never in your face. And what I'm seeing now is that people are becoming much more aware. The consumer is much more educated and is looking for it. So now it's so beautiful that we get to not hide it and just be it. Just be who we are and not have to hide it so that people can find us. And I believe that eventually it will just be the norm, even for big box, because they're going to see their sales going elsewhere. And I think eventually everyone will have to have a component of transparency. Especially with the new generation, those kids are smart, and I believe that there's the majority of them really care. There's a lot of kids I'm meeting these days when I go to and speak at schools who are really passionate about doing what's right for the earth and people.
And where things are made.
Yeah.
When we need to take a break, I want to come back and I want to talk about your brief foray into domestic production, self-owned domestic production. So we'll be right back. Today's episode is made possible through the support of our sponsor, Bank & Vogue, global leaders in the innovative and relevant solutions to the crisis of stuff. The family business is one of the largest brokers and agents of used goods in North America. With the addition of their new manufacturing facility, they can create on-demand, on-trend items using your post-consumer branded goods. Interested in unique solutions to waste that your customers and sustainability officer will love? Visit bankvogue.com to learn more. You're listening to Magnifico Radio, and I'm your host, Kate Black, and today I'm sitting down with ethical fashion designer Nicole Bridger. So just before the break, I said I wanted to talk about your brief foray into domestic production. There's so much rhetoric about bringing manufacturing jobs back to North America, and you owned your own factory for a while. So what are the challenges to matching that rhetoric and the actual reality?
So when I... bought our factory. We've been using it for a number of years, and the owners wanted to retire. And so I said, well, instead of you retiring, why don't I own the business and keep it going, and we'll just put all of our manufacturing here. And very quickly, I saw that the books that they showed me showing it to be profitable wasn't true. And it was hemorrhaging money, which was very tricky, especially to do it right. As I was unearthing things, I found out there was a lot of stuff going on that wasn't ethical. They were outsourcing more than half the production to sweatshops in the city and home sewers, so that it wouldn't cost as much. Then you don't have to pay CPP and WCB and tax and stuff. And I just kept unearthing all these things and kept saying, well, that's not right. We have to do it differently. That's not right. We have to do it differently, which costs more and more money. So we were losing about 250 grand a year owning that factory, and we owned it for 3 years.
And that's not because you didn't have orders, right? Because you were starting to produce for other people,
Yeah. Also
Vancouver-based designers. And like, so it wasn't that you didn't have orders, it was...
Which exacerbated the problem. So yeah, we kept the girls, well, they weren't all girls, but we kept the staff busy by bringing in other orders, but unfortunately, that made the problem much worse. At the worst time, payroll was about 75% of my revenue. It should be about 20%. And so for me, wanting to pay fair wage in a city that living wage is $21 an hour, a lot of the sort of sweatshops will pay less than minimum wage. And so it was interesting for me because I thought, well, maybe local manufacturing isn't the solution. Having a factory in one of the more expensive cities in the world, maybe that doesn't make sense, because how are these people ever going to make a living at, like, you know, $21 an hour? And it's very skilled labor. It's not that the labor doesn't deserve it. It's that the consumer's not willing to pay for that. And so, especially when we were manufacturing for other people, they have margins that they clearly need to make. And asking those outside clients, are you okay with these people not being paid minimum wage just so you can get your margin? Like, and I couldn't believe it. I'm like, well, sorry, we can't work together then. It was really eye-opening for me. And granted, those other companies weren't necessarily ethical, but that even just conventional business owners would turn a blind eye to things just to get stuff made.
And so then what's the solution? So you sold the factory, and where do you produce now?
We closed it. I wish we could have sold it. We had to close it in a mad rush, which was probably the hardest thing I've ever done, laying off 30 people. And they were so sweet. They were worried about me, all these workers who, you know, live paycheck to paycheck, saying, don't worry, we'll be all right. And are you going to be okay? And if you ever open up another factory, we want to come and work for you. I think they have often been poorly treated. And to be treated well by somebody and feel safe was something new for them.
Why does the fashion industry do that? Why is that the impetus of how this industry makes money?
Like, not valuing those people. It's about them being more like robots than humans. They have a job to get done, and it doesn't matter if they need to work all day and night and not get paid much. There's margins to be made. To be honest, it's fear. The systemic fear of our planet of needing money to survive and not caring if our own survival means the suffering of others. That's like the deepest issue.
It's true. But you have a shop, mm-hmm. right? So now you can see the customer and the consumer face to face. Will they pay more? Like, where's the hard turn in this dilemma? The consumer won't pay more, or the brand doesn't have the confidence the consumer will pay more?
I think it's about a huge shift in consumerism. So, I mean, how many hundred years ago, people only had a couple outfits that were made really, really well, that you wore all the time, and then you would pass down. It's only since the Industrial Revolution that we have got to this idea of consuming so much and stuff. It doesn't matter if it doesn't last, because we can just buy more because it's so cheap. And so what I think is that, yes, right now our clients are in a very nice spot where they can afford to spend a little bit extra on clothing. Now, is it possible to have ethical clothing and not make it so expensive? Yes, but there's different ways. So it's about teaching the consumer that we don't need to have so much. First of all, I think we wear about 10% of what's in our closet. This idea of, and again, it's all fear-based, that you are only worthy if you have the latest trend. That needs to shift. It's all this fear-based marketing that has driven people to say, I need it, I need it, I need it. I have a void in my heart and I need to fill it with something. And this is my identity. And so if we can shift that, which is such a huge part of what I'm trying to do, is say, hey, you are perfect just as you are. And you don't need all this stuff. Yes, we need to exist in society and have clothing that functions for our lifestyle. But there's a shift there from a filling a void to a happy existence. And so I think when people start to consume from a whole place, that it really changes how they're buying. And when they start to see what's really going on, then they will be empowered to make better choices. And as better choices become available too, even for myself, trying to find denim right now that I like the fit of, that I think is made ethically, it's challenging. The options are increasing all the time, but it's challenging.
I think actually it's just challenging to find clothes in general, because I think that all the production is kind of overshadowing the style and the design. And I have the same problem. I'm just like, where's the fit models? You know, there's all this talk in New York about, you know, nobody needs fit models anymore. Mm-hmm. That's where we cut corners. And, you know, we're not going to do sampling anymore. That's where we cut corners. And so, like, I feel like the whole industry is just being squeezed for you know, some dimes and nickels. So you had to close the factory quickly. You laid off the staff quickly and sadly. And now there was a void in local production. So within Vancouver, because this kind of factory just disappeared, as they do across the continent, as people realize the financial cost of doing it well and fairly. So what's your new take on production? Where do you produce now?
So we do have at a local factory, so we're outsourcing to a local factory. And then it's freed me up to go find other ethical factories in developing countries. So I met a woman in India. She had come to visit me here with her husband and talk about production. And she's done now the majority of our production, which has been amazing. And I went there to visit for 2 weeks with my son and see the factory, meet the people. And I really like her. We have a great relationship. I really trust her, and she's a similar age to me, and her mother's been in the industry for a long time. So she knows what she's doing, and I feel like we're talking the same language. And she lived in New York for a number of years working in the industry as well, so she understands the Western way of doing business. So she's an absolute gem. And then we also use a fair trade factory in Nepal for cashmere sweaters. And that's been where most of our manufacturing is.
I like that. I like that using the ethical lens or the ethical kind of criteria. And sadly, until we can figure out this problem or this consumer hurdle, dropping the local or finding another workaround for the local so that you can still provide great quality and great products at a price that the consumer can stand. So I have these standard questions that I've been asking everybody at the end of each podcast. If your life had a motto, what would it be?
I think it's to be forever growing, forever learning, forever journeying inward to have a more aligned existence in my spirit.
And that probably explains your longevity in this industry so far. And who or what inspires you?
I think that when I need some inspiration, that spending time with the people that I love, doing things that bring me joy and happiness, spending time in nature, and adventures. Adventures, and that usually looks like traveling with the people I love. I think when we are needing inspiration, when we do the things that bring us joy, that naturally stirs up that flow of divine energy, and then the inspiration comes.
That's true. I feel that actually when I watch your Insta, because you go surfing with your son, you're up in Whistler often, snowboarding, and I can, anytime I'm longing for some nature, I'll just flip onto your feed and I'm like, oh, there it is. There's just something different about being in Canada and having that access to the sea and the mountains and everything right in your backyard. And so what's next on your bucket list? What are you working towards?
Well, it's pretty exciting. So I had a few big epiphanies while I've been. So do we have a few minutes?
Yes.
Okay. So when I closed the factory, I got really sick.
From the stress?
The cortisol, that was pumping from my body. So I had my adrenals were basically shutting down. And I went to see my naturopath and figure out what was going on. I barely had enough energy to get my son to school. I gained weight really quickly. And she said, you've got adrenal exhaust. It takes 3 years for you to get healthy. And I thought, I'm a single mom. I can't get for real sick. I need to. None of this is worth it if I'm going to be sick. So I need to take some time here to journey inward and figure out how I manifested so much stress. What are those belief systems that I'm holding on to that need to shift? And what do I really want in my life? And I was really committed to having joy and ease in my life. And how was I going to manifest that? And I was in the Hamptons one day, and I realized walking around the shops, like, I don't know that I want this. I don't want to have 60 stores. This whole time I've been kind of behind this energy of, okay, once I build this thing and achieve X, Y, and Z, you know, then I'm worthy. And it's happening in my subconscious. But once I shed a light on that, I said, wait a minute. What if I hold a new belief that I'm worthy just as I am? Then what does my life look like? And so I realized also that I don't want to be a part of the problem. You know, in the fashion industry, even doing it ethically, we still have so much waste. And I keep hearing from people that they want to buy less, buy better, have less in their closet. So I decided we would move to core closet collection, which means each season we have only 10 styles. And these are your core basic styles to have in any closet. Then you can style in your own personal way, but that these are pieces that are going to last, that you can rely on for how they've been made, and that you can wear all different ways so that they can take you from work to play, et cetera. So then while I was creating this, you know, and I'm really just trusting where I'm being led. I'm like, okay, I just feel like I need to do this. I don't know what this looks like, but I realized that I don't need to have a whole store in order to have just 10 styles. So we are closing the store. So when this podcast releases, the store will have closed, and we're moving to online and pop-up as the model for the business.
I'm not surprised that your subconscious takes you back to where I remember you kind of really shining. That's when I remember you getting the most traction and having the most press, is you had these few pieces that were so classic and so kind of loved by women of all ages.
Yeah. And getting to do less styles also means that I can shoot every style on 3 to 5 different body types and show what that looks like and really get to stand behind the things that I really believe in.
I love that.
I feel so much
as a woman with
hips.
I'm really happy about a designer who's going to incorporate some styles for our hips.
Yeah, for all women. I mean, everybody's a different shape. And so then I'm already feeling so much lighter and ease that I'm now looking at writing a book, actually. So I've been spending my time writing this book, doing more speaking engagements, and that the message of I am love can take a different platform. So I'm really excited about this new chapter as I start to share with others my story of how I've journeyed inward in the hopes that somebody out there might resonate to something that helps them along their journey too.
And so how can people follow along? How can they stay on the journey and on the path with you for this shift in collection and as well for the book launch and for things that are going to come down the road?
Definitely our Instagram page, Facebook, both are Nicole Bridger. You can go to our website, nicolebridger.com, and join our newsletter. And stay tuned because I'm going to start a YouTube channel and be talking a lot about all these things and a podcast too. So I'm excited about it. Yeah.
That's exciting. Okay. And so that's Nicole, N-I-C-O-L-E, Bridger, B-R-I-D-G-E-R.com. .com or .ca?
.com.
Thank you so much for sharing your great news, Nicole. I wish you all the best.
And thank you, Kate, too. Thank you for all that you do to promote this work. You have been such a shining star for all of us, and I really appreciate everything that you do. So thank you.
Thank you. That's been another episode of Magnifico Radio. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to great podcasts. And if you like what you hear, give us a review or a rating. It'll help Magnifico Radio rank higher amongst conventional fashion and beauty podcasts. And if you have a question or want to be on the show, email me radio@magnifico, M-A-G-N-I-F-E-C-O.com. Until next time, thanks for listening.